From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The crisis in Yemen has been declared a level 3, the highest designation used by UN humanitarian relief agencies, intended to produce an emergency response by the UN and international non-governmental organizations. A UN spokesperson said that aid agencies agreed to declare the Level 3 emergency plan for a period of 6 months. Under the plan, the agencies will increase efforts to reach millions of people affected by the war. Level 3 is the global humanitarian systems classification for a response to the most severe large-scale humanitarian crises. 4.4 million Yemenis have reportedly been reached with aid in the past 3 months, but the UN says this is a fraction of those in need. Stephanie Kutrix filed this report from the United Nations.
All UN agencies have agreed to declare a Level 3 emergency response for Yemen, the highest possible and equal to the level of response in Syria, Iraq, and South Sudan. In the past 3 months, some 3,000 Yemenis have been killed, half of them civilians, and 14,000 injured. Over a million people have had to flee their homes, and 21 million need immediate help. In a statement, the UN Secretary General repeated his call for an immediate end to the fighting in Yemen to help stem the unfolding of what he called a humanitarian catastrophe in the country. He called on the parties to agree, at the very minimum, on an immediate pause in hostilities until the end of the holy month of Ramadan so that aid can be delivered into and across Yemen. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
We're going to win on Sunday, and we're going to be here to forge a mutually beneficial agreement with the rest of Europe.
That was Greece's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, in an interview Thursday, predicting a strong no vote in this coming Sunday's referendum on what he said was the unworkable and unsustainable model of more austerity and privatization demanded by the country's creditors.
This is a question of, do we challenge the established logic, which in our view is irrational, that you need to impose the greatest austerity on the most recessionary economy. And they don't like the idea that we're going to challenge that, you know, that supposed logic.
Varoufakis explained exactly what Sunday's referendum is about.
On the 25th of June, in the Eurogroup, I was presented with a very comprehensive proposal by the institutions. It was more or less on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. And what we said was, for us, just reading it, and I'm sure that any independent observer would agree with this, this was another extend and pretend. If we were to agree on that, we would be extending the crisis for another few months. The banks would be open, but we would have exactly the same situation as we've had in the last 5 months. So what we're saying to the Greek people is, no more extend and pretend. Please back us to say no, not to any, to a deal, but to this deal, which has absolutely no specific funding proposal coming with it, and no debt sustainability analysis that is worth the paper that is written on. So this is what we're saying no to. This kind of mentality where, yeah, just sign up, take a small tranche of money just to tie you over for a few months, and then we come back to the same crisis, to the same crunch negotiation. It's time to end this.
The finance minister said that a no vote would help the government get a much better deal out of Brussels.
If a no vote, as we are recommending to the Greek people, is delivered, then we will immediately start negotiations, and believe you me, there is going to be an agreement along lines that are different to that of the institutions.
He also pointed out that the recently imposed banking restrictions, which have caused long lines at ATMs around the country, were the result not of the government's economic policies, but of political manipulations by European creditors.
You have to understand that there's a profound difference between what happened in Cyprus, let's say, in 2013 and what's happening here. This is not a banking crisis. It's not that the banks are the problem. According to the ECB and to the SSM, the banks were perfectly capitalized. There was no problem with them. What is happening is there is a political decision by the Eurogroup to shut the banks down as a way of effectively pushing us to accept a non-viable agreement at the political level. So this is a political crisis. Once the political crisis is over, after the Greek people deliver their verdict, the banks will open.
Greece's creditors continued their hard line Thursday. Germany's finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, placed the blame for the current impasse on Athens.
This government has done nothing since it came into office. It's reneged on previously agreed commitments. You can't in all honesty expect us to talk with them in a situation like this.
Despite the added hardship imposed by the ECB, people on the streets of Athens seem to strongly support their government's position in the negotiations.
What they're essentially saying is that your own government is the enemy and we're your friends. Just don't bike anymore.
They're trying to polarize the Greek society, and this is going to create a lot of problems.
I want to be in Europe on my own terms, not as a poor corner of Europe. I'm glad to hear Mr. Tsipras will stay with us. It is good that he sticks to his convictions. All the others have betrayed us. That is why I trust him.
Telesur's Lee Brown spoke with Yorgos Gogos, a Greek longshore worker, union organizer, and member of the leftist governing Syriza coalition, about the mood of defiance on display on the streets of Greece ahead of Sunday's referendum.
The situation is completely new for us and for the new elected government. And also it's something unique that the institutions are facing nowadays, because government decided to listen to the voice of Greek people. And it's obvious by their attitude so far and their reactions after the announcement of the referendum that they don't want to listen to our voice. And Greek people do not want to continue the austerity measures. And we think that the majority will vote not to go on with the proposal of the institutions, because it continues the same recipe of austerity, privatization, and deterioration of Greek economy.
And on both sides, how is the mobilization? The left have held a big demonstration, and I saw yesterday there was a large demonstration from the right wing. How do you feel the campaign is going in on behalf of the left?
I think it's going fine. We have limited time to take these initiatives. It was also something new for us when we heard the Prime Minister to announce the referendum. So we had less than a week to make all these preparations. And the point is that people are ready to say no to austerity. And the system, and also assisted by the mass media that are here in Greece, they are trying to change the opinion of Greek people. It's a big problem that the banks are not open, and we have a limited amount of money that we can take from ATMs. But people react in this very calm and cool, waiting in the queues so as to take this 60 euros per day, which in total it's in a monthly base, it's more than the average salary in Greece, I have to tell you. The more problem there is with the pensioners who do not have the card, so as the debit card, so as to take money from ATM. And today we had longer queues in the banks waiting to open the cashiers and take money from their pensions. We don't want to continue this kind of projects and plans followed by austerity and all these measures that we faced the last 5 years and made worse the situation for Greek economy and for Greek people.
And obviously Greece is at the centre of an international battle for or against austerity. It seems that there are lots of foreign leaders, Angela Merkel and others, are intervening into your debate inside Greece. What impact is that having on the Greek population, that it's external forces intervening into your own democratic process?
Yes. People has understood that this intervention is not for the positive for ourselves. They are trying to intervene and to change the decision of Greek people. And they will try hard to do this. And they are keeping on taking all the necessary and undemocratic measures so as to change the opinion of Greek people. The point is for European leaders to understand that the Greek crisis, it's not a Greek one, it's a European one. And now it's not anymore a financial crisis only, it's also a democratic crisis. It's something unacceptable for us that European leaders do not want to hear the voice of Greek people asking for solidarity, asking for measures that are not going to give, the final strike on Greek people. We want some time and some space so as to breathe and recover and try to solve our problems by ourselves. Unfortunately, the last 35 years, 40 years almost, Greek politicians were very much connected with people who were strong, and they had been very powerful in politics, in economy, in everywhere. So politics the last 40 years were interconnected with very strong financial interests. And this is the main problem of Greek economy. Greek society decided in the last elections to change page, to leave behind all this. And European leaders has to listen to our request so as to give some space and time and to solve these problems and to try to find a solution within European Union in a democratic way.
And can I ask you about the media within Greece? Is there fairness and balance within in the media, or is the media attached to these powerful interests that you've just been describing?
Unfortunately, the Greek mass media, they are quite biased and attached to the directions by the European leaders. They are trying to impose the yes opinion to Greek people and to vote so in the next referendum of next Sunday, in 5th of July. I think Greek people will react accordingly and they will vote for no, because all this pressure, all this news that are especially from the private mass media, they are too biased, and we are fed up with this story.
And you're very optimistic that the population will say no to the latest austerity measures.
I hear to my relatives, I hear to my colleagues saying that enough is enough, and we cannot go on with this. We don't. We want to be part of European Union, but we have to be as European citizens to save our sovereignty, our to live decently the next years. And this will happen only if we say no to this referendum. We cannot afford any more austerity measures like this imposed the last 5 years. I'm optimistic because I hear people around me. I don't watch the TV news.
And if Greeks vote no, what do you think will happen next?
Greek government asked from Greek people to say no to this to the last proposal by Europeans. And they asked this because they want to continue the negotiations with European institutions and IMF. The point is to find a viable and sustainable solution about the national debt. This is the first thing. Some measures we know that they have to be imposed so as to comply with the previous program and the next one. But without any solution with national debt, there is no opportunity to do this. So we are asking for further time for negotiation to stop using these measures of, for example, stopping the liquidity to the country, which leads to this suffocation of Greek economy. And the last attempt was the closing of the banking system. So we don't want to continue European leaders with these decisions and to sit on a table and discuss sincerely about the financial problem.
Could you say a little bit about what Syriza has done or what has happened since the new government came to power to fight off privatizations, both in your own industry and in wider industries?
Yes. This government, even before the elections, they didn't want to continue privatization program, and they declared that they will stop privatizations. When we had the first declarations inside the Greek parliament, they also repeated this commitment, and we were very happy for this, because privatizations, especially in fields like, in sectors like ports, in Greek airports, they're very crucial for Greek economy and generally for any economy, because we're talking about privatization of infrastructure, of unique infrastructure that was created by Greek people. So it's not, for example, like privatizing a public factory of making shoes, for example. And there is a possibility always after some time, some years, to build up next to the privatized one public one again. We're talking about a unique infrastructure that is something that it cannot be created from the beginning. Piraeus Port Authority, for example, it's an organization, a public organization, profitable one for the last 80 years. So privatizing this port, the bigger port of Greece, it's a matter of sovereignty. It's not just privatizing a company.
Finally, what role do you believe that international solidarity, the solidarity we're seeing from Spain, from Britain and from the rest of the world, what role do you think that plays in the struggle that the Greek people are undertaking?
First of all, it's encouraging for Greek people. It's very important to see European people to resist to such a neoliberal and very dogmatic decisions. So it's very encouraging for ourselves, every Greek people. At the other, on the other side, it's very encouraging for Greek government, because this is the point. It's the day and the point that people have to speak. It's not on the decision on some leaders that are, especially like the Germans, one who are a completely neoliberal direction. The point is European people to speak, to show solidarity, and to go on in a common European way together.
The specter of a default on payments to foreign creditors is not limited to Athens or Puerto Rico. The U.S.-backed government in Ukraine appears poised for a default by the end of the month. The Kiev government is seeking to restructure its debt. However, little progress has been made in negotiations with the country's creditors. Press TV's Daria Degutz filed this report from Kiev.
Since the beginning of 2015, Ukraine has been facing a deep economic crisis, hit with a national currency devaluation by 70% and a massive essential GDP drop. As the deadline for the next bond repayment is nearing, the country's finance minister, Natalie Jureska, does not rule out the possibility of Kyiv suspending the looming payoff.
Halting the payments on our foreign debts means a technical default, but we shouldn't be afraid of it. It won't affect our banking system.
The authorities of the war-torn country struggled to restructure the $15 billion debt, insisting on a 40% write-down, which private investors are opposed to. The government has made offers with some new conditions, that to no avail, however.
We have to reach an agreement till autumn. This is a very tough restructuring plan, but inevitable. Sooner or later, the creditors will accept the terms.
With the negotiations in deadlock, Kyiv is heading to a financial collapse. However, analysts say Ukraine's scenario does differ from that of Greece.
Greece defaulted on the IMF loan, but Kyiv is negotiating its debts to private investors. In this case, the IMF rather supports Kyiv's position than pushing it to accept the conditions of the creditors.
Ukraine is critically dependent on financial aid. The IMF approved $17.5 billion in loans for Kyiv to avert an economic collapse, demanding in turn tough austerity measures and reforms. Following the financial crisis in Greece, the International Monetary Fund has pledged support for Ukraine, stating that the country will secure the next IMF loan tranche, regardless of the results of the debt negotiations. Daria Diguts, Press TV, Kyiv.
Meanwhile, growing opposition to Washington's involvement in Ukraine was evident on the streets of Kyiv Wednesday, where hundreds of protesters gathered outside the American embassy, demanding that the U.S. get out of the country. Protesters carried signs that read, USA, the world's evil, shame, and Yankees get out of Ukraine. Many carried large, full-color photos of the destruction caused by the U.S.-backed war on the east of the country, including pictures of bombed-out buildings and dead children. On Tuesday, the Ukrainian hacker collective Cyber Berkut published excerpts from a report by Ukraine's Southern Region military prosecutor detailing widespread criminal activity by Kyiv-allied volunteer battalions in eastern Ukraine and by regular units of the armed forces and security services. The fighting groups in question, which include Idar, Donbas, Luhansk 1, and other volunteer battalions, are mostly under the formal command of Ukraine's National Guard. The 80-page report covering just the battalions in the area of the Luhansk region under Ukrainian control showed that the groups committed hundreds of crimes ranging from armed assault and robbery to kidnapping and murder. The report also documented cases of armed clashes between the volunteer units and official units of the National Guard, with one document being a request by a National Guard commander for his troops to be awarded medals for the detention of Idar battalion fighters. Since the start of the crisis in Ukraine in late 2013, Cyber Berkut has released a series of high-profile hacked documents, some detailing the high casualty rates among the Ukrainian army. The releases also revealed the presence of snipers on Maidan Square and, the most widely reported, Victoria Nuland's famous FTEU telephone exchange with U.S. Ambassador Geoffrey Pyatt. BP has apparently reached a settlement agreement over its liability for the massive 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The tentative $18.7 billion settlement would cover lawsuits filed by the states of Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, as well as by the federal government. The largest sums would reportedly be paid out over 15 to 18 years, beginning a year after the agreement's approval by the federal court. BP put the value of the settlement at $18.7 billion, and the states reportedly gave similar figures, while the U.S. Justice Department said the total value of the settlement could top $20 billion. The process of obtaining the top-secret Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty's fast-track approval in Congress rested on what one analyst called choreographed corruption by House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi. Kevin Zeese from the group Popular Resistance said during an interview with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford that the fight is not over.
Oh, definitely not. This is the end of this round. It would have been better if they had not provided Obama this power to fast-track these trade agreements, but we still can fight each trade agreement. The next battle will be over the Trans-Pacific Partnership itself. It will come in the fall. We don't know exactly when yet. We'll get a sense of that in the next couple months. But we're gearing up for that battle. There's a lot of anger in response to what people see as clear corruption that was very choreographed. It's choreographed because they got exactly 218 votes in the House, which is the majority number, 218. They got exactly 60 votes in the Senate, which is the majority number. Not one vote over in each chamber. Nancy Pelosi did her job of fooling progressives into thinking she was on their side, and in fact really helping President Obama to get the exact number of votes he needed, 218 in the House. That was the critical vote, and we know it. Her failure, because when the vote was going into the House, there were only about 20 Democrats who supported it. When the vote actually happened, there were 28, the exact number needed. And when the vote was re-voted, not one of those 28 changed. A real leader who opposed Fast Track certainly could have changed a handful of those votes and denied President Obama this power. But she was always on Obama's side, and so she gave him what he needed. And so we saw the choreographed corruption, and people are very angry about it. People are ready for a revolt.
And so we're looking for an up or down vote in the fall.
The whole treaty will come up, and there are three treaties. The first one is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The second one is the transatlantic version with Europe. And the third one, which I think is the most damaging, includes 50 nations, and it's the Trade and Services Agreement. Services cover 80% of the U.S. economy, everything from accounting services to postal services to education and health services or financial services. So it's 80% of the U.S. economy. That's the most dangerous. The Congress will be blowing each of those three treaties, if they complete the negotiations, individually. And the first to come up will be the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It'll come up as one large document. One thing that we won in the fast-track effort was an additional 60 days to supposedly see the treaty. And before the fast-track process starts, the clock starts running on that. So we have 60 days to educate and organize people and mobilize them. We really need to mobilize people. We need to see another Battle of Seattle. We need to see another Miami trade fight. We need to see some real anger in the streets. There was a populist rebellion before these votes, before these choreographed votes, where hundreds of thousands of people every week were calling the Senate and the House, probably more than a million calls in the last 3 weeks. So there's a lot of mobilization on the phones, and that was ignored. And that's why they limited their vote to the exact majority, because they didn't want to put other political careers at risk. They knew the public was angry. They knew the Democratic base did not support this, and so they just had the bare number supported so that they could get the votes they needed. So we saw that insecurity on that part. Now we have to be more angry. We have to show a visceral anger. The great thing about this, it would be in an election year. That will mean that elected officials will be even more nervous, more afraid of the voters, especially the voters show that kind of anger. It means we could get this into the presidential debates and make this a national issue. There's disagreements among Republicans as well as Democrats about these trade agreements. The Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton types support them, although try to hide it. And there are the grassroots types like Bernie Sanders, and on the right, people like Ted Cruz, who actually oppose it. And so it's going to be very interesting to see that debate unfold. There's an opportunity for us to boomerang this fast-track vote into a national debate on whether rigged corporate trade that puts the profits of ultra mega transnational corporations ahead of the needs of the people and the protection of the planet. So it's a great opportunity for a very big debate that could really undermine these corporate trade agreements for a very long time.
So is the whole country going to get to see the whole of this treaty? Previously, congresspersons could look at parts of it, but couldn't even take notes.
That's right. And that's still true. In fact, what happens is the Congress goes down to a little room in Congress, and then the Congress member is there with a U.S. Trade Representative staff person overlooking, watching them over their shoulder. They can't bring paper, pen, computer, telephone, camera, anything to record what's in it. And they're warned that if they say what's in it, they're faced with criminal charges. What they get to see is only one of the three trade agreements, the TPP. And with the TPP, they mostly get summaries and a lot of blacked out sections. So even when they go through all that rigmarole, they still can't see the treaty in full. Under the fast-track agreement, under the law that just passed, it says that for 60 days, Congress will get a copy of the treaty, full treaty, to be seen, and so that people know what they're voting on. Now, whether that means that the public will get to see it is not yet really clear. Whether that full treaty will be the blacked-out summary type that they get to see now, that would not be what the law meant, but that may be what they end up doing. So we may have a fight about that, what people can see there. But I think this lack of transparency issue is going to be one that backfires against them. We've had enough weeks now that we know what's in these treaties. We know the direction they're going, and it's all toward corporate power, loss of sovereignty for people and nations and local and state governments. We know that's the direction they're going. And so even if they keep it secret, we have a lot of ammunition to fight this with. And if the failure to make it public will provide more ammunition. So we're going to fight for as much transparency as we can get.
One would think that at least one congressman would reveal the treaty quite publicly and dare the administration to arrest him or her.
That would be a great step. And the one who came closest to that in this previous round was Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, not someone I'm usually in political agreement with. He went down and read the agreement, then he wrote a 7-page letter highlighting some of the key points that he read about, and he sent it to all of the senators of both parties. That got reported in the media by Breitbart, They must have seen the letter, and they quoted large parts of it. And so that was the closest we came to a senator doing that. You know, the problem is that the senators don't get to keep a copy, or the congress members don't get to keep a copy of the what they see in that basement room. So they had to come back and, from their memory, you know, write a summary. So that's one of the challenges. It's not like Daniel Ellsberg can leak the, no one's leaked the text to a senator so that can be read on the Senate floor.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.